Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. Tonight, I'm going to try to get across an important concept. I really enjoyed having Hans Krampe on the past two Heretics Hour programs. We talked about waking up to the truth about 20th century history from the typical brainwashed state of mind. And we talked about the Nuremberg Tribunal that took place in 1946. Now, Hans also brought up the Rudolf Hess flight to Scotland in June 1941. I've been reading a very good book, Memoirs of Otto Wagner, who worked closely with Adolf Hitler in 1929, 1930, and 31. And in Wagner's recollection, Hitler speaks a lot about his unwavering belief that England, that's Hitler's unwavering belief, that England would join together with Germany against the Bolshevist Soviet Union. He felt it was the only rational course for Britain, and that they were a rational people who could not help but see the wisdom of this. And he expected that they would, and no one could talk him out of that idea. Reading about this, and reading Hitler's words, according to Wagner, but I think, I just feel like he's giving his best recollection of it. It finally took hold in my mind that Hitler knew. He knew about the Hess flight. I have not wanted to believe that in the past, and I was kind of convinced that he didn't know. But when I read so much about Hitler's own belief in the destiny of England to be a part of a united Europe against the East, and that he saw that as more possible than it was, because it was so clear in his mind. He saw it almost like a very clear vision of the future, which indeed has come to pass, but not certainly in a timely manner and not soon enough. So that's one thing. I'm not going to go into that anymore, because again, we don't really know, but I'm now inclined to think that certainly, Hess didn't do that without Hitler's, at least, approval. Maybe Hitler was remaining somewhat distanced from it, but had his approval. This is also what was behind his allowing the British forces to retreat at Dunkirk. He said more than once that British power was necessary for the strength of Europe, or for Europe to hold its own vis-a-vis the U.S. industrial power on the one hand, and the Russian industrial power on the other hand. Hitler correctly understood that the United States had become very competitive and wanted to become the superpower of the world. We have seen that he was correct in that. But the British chose to align with the United States and Russia against Germany and its European allies. How to explain that? Well, there's something else at work here. That is the deep Jewish infiltration of both the British and the American ruling class. The Soviet Union also was run by Jews at that time. So the question is, how big a part did Jews play in everything that happened? A question comes up about Roosevelt. Hans brought up that Roosevelt was a Jew, and when he did, I expressed a different opinion. I didn't really like that. I don't like to say that Roosevelt was a Jew, but I think Hans is probably right. I did some research and came up with some persuasive information. Roosevelt's oldest known ancestor was Claes Martensen von Rosenvelt, who came to New Amsterdam from Holland in 1649 and died in 1658. Now, New Amsterdam, of course, became New York. So he came to this country, to the U.S. country, in 1649. Now, there are no records about Claes in Holland. I think that's kind of strange. Holland was a civilized nation, and they certainly had records on everyone, birth records, marriage records, various sorts like that. And why would there be no records about this man? Anyway, he had two sons, and one of them provided Franklin's ancestral line. And here's something. Roosevelt said in March 1935, it was at a press conference of some sort, and a reporter asked him a question. I believe that's the context here. And Roosevelt is on record as saying, "My ancestors came to America from Holland over 300 years ago. I am not worried about whether or not they were Jewish." I think the reporter actually came out and asked him whether he had, that there was talk that he had Jewish, that he was part Jewish. Now, that I find that very strange. That's an odd way to put that. Why wouldn't he say, "I have no reason to believe that I have any Jewish ancestors," or something, or "I do have Jewish ancestry," but to say, "I'm not worried whether they," he's saying it's not important. It has no relevance whether I have any Jews in my family, you know, whether I'm part Jewish. So I'm not concerned about it, and in extension, you shouldn't be either. Now, I know that, and I'm a far more humble person than the Roosevelt family, my family is, and I know my ancestry, and I have it all documented on my father's side. I haven't gotten around on my mother's side, but it's similar, back to 1700, and it's clear to me there's no Jews. There's no place they would have gotten in there. Of course, my family stayed in the same location. They weren't moving around, and they weren't, you know, marrying people from far away. They were pretty much marrying people in their area. So, you know, you can tell that. But, you know, I don't see why he wouldn't know. He would know, but he doesn't want to say. Now, another factor, FDR surrounded himself with socialist Jews even when he was governor of New York, and many were appointed to top jobs in the Roosevelt administration. A list was compiled of these Jews in his presidential administration, and there were 73 on this list. And these are not just minor bureaucrats. These are heads of agencies and departments and important things and top advisors to Roosevelt. 73. The list is incredible when you see it. And, of course, headed by Bernard Baruch, who was very much involved with all the international jewelry, and Felix Frankfurter, who kind of pretended like he wasn't. He was on the Supreme Court, but he also was a spokesman for international jewelry. Now, you know, again, speaking back to my own humble self, if I were president, or if many of you listening were president, there would be no Jews in our administration. I mean, we can tell the difference between a Jew and a non-Jew. And so what we've known for a long time, of course, that FDR's administration had so many Jews in it, in top positions, is notable. Now, there's a good article where someone named Christopher Jones is writing in a sedate kind of scholarly discussion with some others. I think it's a Stanford University source. But he is more open or critical about the Jews in our government. And this is not recent either. This is back a few years. But he says that the gentleman listed in this list of 73 people in Roosevelt's government, that they participated in a government that literally kowtowed to Joseph Stalin, he says. And he's asking why. And he says, quote, "He cannot turn a blind eye to the special moral standard that was set in place in 1945. The special moral standard," he put it, is in quotes. This special moral standard is what was done in 1945, which I'm going to be talking about. "The longer people refuse to recognize the dangers of this situation, the more likely a disaster will take place." Well, that's very well put, because so true. Today we can see this so clearly, because what was set in place in 1945 with the Nuremberg Tribunal and the establishment of this New World Order was created what we have today, and it's gone even further, far further than it was then. And if people couldn't recognize the danger then, certainly it's in our face today. It's all over. It's exploding everywhere around us. And people still are not wanting to see a disaster, although many people do see that there's a disaster in store, but they feel unable or incapable of doing anything about it because they are not able to speak the truth or what they really see and understand, which is to mention the word Jew in relation to this. And so that's what I'm going to be continuing to do tonight. Now, there's another source here. There was about Roosevelt. There's an American Freedom magazine that was in Los Angeles, California. And this is an issue from April 1938. Now, this is no doubt an anti-Roosevelt magazine. No doubt these were more right-wing pro-America first people, I imagine. But they reproduced a quotation below, and I'm going to quote it. In their 1938, they said, in an address to the National Convention of the DAR, President F.D. Roosevelt said that he, too, was of revolutionary ancestry. But not a Roosevelt was in the American Army. They were Tories, busy entertaining British officers. The first Roosevelt came to America in 1649. His name was Claes Rosenfeld. He was Jew. Now, they're saying he was Jew. Now, as we know, we don't have hard proof that he was Jew, but they don't worry about that because, as I say, these all media say whatever they want to say, whether it's right or left. I try to be very accurate, but media, as we know, comes out with things that they can't really fully back up. But anyway, it goes on to say Nicholas, the son of Claes, was the ancestor of both Franklin and Theodore. He married a Jewish girl named Kunst in 1682. Now, here again, they're saying that Nicholas married a Jewish girl. I don't know that they have any proof that she's a Jewish girl, but they're saying it. I don't take that as truth. It could be true. Nicholas had a son named Jacobus Rosenfeld. In the family tree, there are 351 persons bearing biblical names of the tribe of Israel. Now, it's used in a lot of cases where they point out that people in families, they have a name from the Old Testament, and that means that they're Jewish. Well, of course it doesn't, because so many Christians use those names from the Old Testament in those days. So, but it is unusual. 351 persons bearing biblical names in the Roosevelt or Rosenfeld family tree. That is kind of a lot. So we have these things that that you have to say this is not too normal in a non-Jewish, totally non-Jewish family. Now, here's something else. FDR's Distinguished Service to Jewry Medal that he got in 1937. In 1937, the New York Jews designed and struck off a medal with the head of Roosevelt on one side and the six-point Solomon Star, which this magazine calls a synagogue symbol of possession and world power, on the other side, and a mystical good luck idiom in the center of the star. The magazine investigated and came up with the implication, they say, that the significance of this symbol, the synagogue symbol of the star, Solomon Star, was, quote, good luck and wisdom to Franklin D. Roosevelt, our modern Moses, leading Jewry in the promised land, America, under the seal of Solomon. Well, this is something that the Jews did, and we know that Jews are always trying to make out that those in power are friends of theirs, and, you know, they're on very good relations. They think so highly of the Jews and so on. So they do things like this. But it still could have significance because they did it. They gave him another one in 1938. That first one was called the Gotthiel Medal for Distinguished Services to Jewry. And Roosevelt was the 10th person to get that award. And then in 1938, according to the New York Herald Tribune, in December, he was given another Jewish medal. So at this point, we're still uncertain about Roosevelt, but it seems likely, very likely, that he has some Jewish ancestry, some Jewish genes. And, well, you know, he lived in New York, and all the Jews came to New York and stayed in New York, and in New York City, too, and the Roosevelt family came to New York, and they remained in New York as he became governor of New York, and he was a New York native, New York State native, so that's a far-fetched thing, but all in all, it seems very likely. I'm going to move on right now to the Nuremberg Tribunal, a timeline I want to give you. And this is very interesting because in January 1st, 1942, there was a declaration. It wasn't the United Nations. It was the nations, the allied nations. They called themselves the United Nations. They were united against the Axis powers. And in January, the very beginning of 1942, less than a month after the United States entered the war, they already vowed in this declaration they came out with in Washington, D.C., so it was under the auspices of the Roosevelt administration. They vowed to continue hostilities against the Axis powers until such powers lay down their arms on the basis of unconditional surrender. So already they were declaring that they would only accept, they would fight until there was an unconditional surrender from the other side. And, of course, no nation ever wants to surrender unconditionally. That is total slavery and abject on your knees. So right there they were stating already that there was going to be no peace treaty, there was going to be no conditions, they were going to the only thing that was acceptable to the Allies was to destroy Germany and do whatever they wanted with them, take total control of that country and its allies. The same with Japan, although this was aimed at, the Axis powers, okay. All of them. Now, in August of that year of 1942, there was a Moscow conference, and Joseph Stalin hosted Avril Harriman, and remember our friend Avril Harriman from the Bush-Nazi connection. He supposedly was working with the Nazis, but actually he was always pro-Soviet, and Roosevelt appointed him ambassador to the Soviet Union. So this only appeals then to those who say that the Nazis and the communists, the Bolsheviks, were one and the same, and they were both Jewish run and both puppets and of the bankers and so on, all that nonsense. But anyway, we have here Stalin, Harriman, and Churchill was there. Roosevelt didn't go himself. And they discussed a common war strategy, and they had this Moscow conference. In December of that year, the Allies made a proclamation, which they broadcast to the world, announcing their intention to punish the war criminals of the Axis powers. This is December 1942. Now, in 1942, Germany was doing very well. The Axis powers were doing very well, certainly in Europe, and that was Hitler's best year. And yet, during this whole year, the Allies were insisting that their intention was to declare these Germans war criminals at the end of the war and to demand unconditional surrender. In 1943, they again announced this, same announcement. And in October of 1943, there was a Moscow declaration stating that fascist leaders and army generals, known or suspected to be war criminals, will be arrested and handed over to justice. So, they were making it very clear what the fate was. And this only encouraged the Third Reich and the Hitler regime to continue fighting with all their might, because they were saying, we're not going to have a peace treaty, therefore we're going to fight to the bitter end. And they felt confident once the United States came into the picture that they would win. And, of course, they had good reason to be confident of that. And so they, the idea that peace, they were against peace. There was not going to be any peace. They were going to carry out the way they ended up doing. So now we go to 1944, in August of 44. Now, it's getting closer to the end, but it certainly was not the end. And the Hitler regime was hoping to pull out something in the way of miracle weapons. That's what Hitler was hoping on. Miracle weapons that were under, different things were under development. So he was not giving up. But Henry Morgenthau now submitted his final plan for post-war treatment of Nazi leaders to Roosevelt. And this became known, of course. This was, everybody knew this. So it was to shoot many leaders upon capture, use German POWs to rebuild Europe. That is, they would be slave labor. For who knows how long, and tear down all German industry and remake Germany as an agricultural society. So once again, you know, this was very dire and extreme, what they were proposing openly, and of course the Germans knew about it. Now, in September, Colonel Murray Bernays, who was actually Cohen, his name was Murray Cohen, and he took the name of Bernays. I'll talk more about him later. He was brought into the War Department in their special project branch as an attorney, and he was to develop the framework to be used at Nuremberg. And what he proposed was that the Nazi regime be treated as a criminal plot, and that they would make the waging of war of aggression, they would make the waging of war a crime. So, in February, 1945 now, they had the Yalta Conference, and Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin agreed to prosecute Axis leaders after victory. So they, you know, there was going to be, once again, there was no hope. February 11th, 1945, the United States and the Soviet Union signed a special agreement between themselves relating to prisoners of war and civilians liberated by forces operating under Soviet command and under United States command. You know, they're using that word liberated. They're liberating civilians, and I don't know if they can call, if they mean the word liberated to relate to mean the prisoners of war, but they were, the civilians of Germany were certainly not liberated, nor of some other countries. They didn't see themselves as being liberated, and they didn't ask to be liberated. But they are forcing this, they always call it liberation anyway, what they did. Their occupation, they call liberation. In March, the text of the Yalta Agreement was released publicly by the State Department, and again it affirmed the Atlantic Charter that liberated people will destroy the last vestiges of fascism and create democratic institutions of their own choice. Well, nothing was created of people's own choice. So again, you know, they are such liars. On April 12, 1945, Roosevelt finally died, and Harry Truman then went ahead and asked the Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson to serve as the U.S. prosecutor in Nuremberg. What Nuremberg hadn't been decided upon yet, but this actually had already been decided by Roosevelt, and Harry Truman was just carrying it out. So on April 25th, 1945, Adolf Hitler had not committed suicide yet. They were still, the Germans were still fighting as best they could, defending Berlin. And the San Francisco Conference began, forming the United Nations, as agreed, by the protocol of the Yalta Conference. So they were continuing to carry this out. They had already decided they would create the United Nations organization under their control, the Yalta Conference people. And on May 8th, of course, then that was Capitulation Day, and Truman declared Allied victory in Europe, and Germany could do nothing else but sign the surrender papers. They were bombed into submission, as we know. Now, on June 26, Jackson leaves for London, and on July 7th, they all decided to recommend Nuremberg as the site for the upcoming trial. Why? Well, Nuremberg was bombed out, but the Palace of Justice there with the prison attached to it was still intact. And also, it was a site of the NSDAP party rallies. It was really the symbolic home of the National Socialist Party. So this was very symbolic that they wanted to hold their trials to make the this party and everything that it did criminal and punish it in this location. Now, on August 6th, the United States dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. But this made no impact on the idea of war crimes and who were the war criminals. On August 8th, 2 days later, the Allies signed a London Agreement mandating prosecution of war criminals by something they called the International Military Tribunal. I want you to know that it's often called trials, the Nuremberg trials and international military trials and so, but there weren't trials. They had to call it a tribunal, a military tribunal, because they didn't follow any of the rules in any of these countries that of their of law for people who are defendants at a trial. And they didn't call these poor victims of their justice defendants either. They called them war criminals right from the start. So they were, you know, you say we're going to bring these war criminals to justice is what they said. So it was all decided on. Now that's as far as I'm going to go. You know, the verdicts were handed down in October 1st, 1946, and on October 16th was the day of hanging, and people say that it was had something to do with Purim. But it was not Purim. Purim is in the spring. This is in the fall. But it was true that it was very like Purim because 10 people were hanged because the 11th, Goering, had committed suicide before that. So it was a joyous day for the Jews in which they were able to hang their enemies just like they did on Purim. And that's the connection with Purim. Well, it's time for the news break, ladies and gentlemen. When we come back, I will continue with some more detailed information about the beginnings of this whole concept of Nuremberg.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR. ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Let's get some thoughts about that and talk to Mahdi Darius Nezimroyes from the Centre for Research on Globalisation, joining us from Ottawa. Thanks for being on RT again, it's appreciated. I mean, there's mounting speculation, isn't there, that Washington is considering arming and training the rebels. What basis do we have for that now? Are we any clearer that that will or won't happen?
Well, based on American sources, they are helping the rebels. A couple of weeks ago, an American official told the Chicago Tribune that CIA officials are in Libya.
Okay.
Now, before
yes, do carry on.
Before that, Reuters said that before President Obama passed the rebels, the CIA was already on the ground. The U.S. has invited the Egyptian military to send weapons into the rebels. The rebels are very much being supported by the United States and NATO.
Right, we've got a bit of a bad line there, I'm afraid. Let's try and persevere with one more question. So it goes, if not, I'm afraid we'll have to leave this interview. It's just a bit of a sound problem. I mean, if these people are armed, there's a worry, isn't there, that Al-Qaeda has infiltrated some of these rebel groups. So Washington could, in fact, be handing arms to Al-Qaeda, the very thing it didn't want to do.
Yes, in fact, at the United States Senate Armed Services Committee, they mentioned that there are Al-Qaeda elements involved or similar elements that are terrorists involved in this rebellion in eastern Libya. So, yes, they are going to arm terrorists.
Now, following the recent NATO airstrike that killed 13 rebels, as we were reporting yesterday, is this the early stages, do you think, of another Iraq and Afghanistan, where coalition attempts to establish peace are in fact claiming innocent lives?
Well, if you look at Yugoslavia, after the bombings were done in Kosovo, NATO itself admitted that they bombed, they killed more Albanians than the Serbs did. They were, their bombs are indiscriminate in who they kill. In fact, I also want to point out that the head of the spokesperson for the Transitional Council apologized when their people were killed by NATO. This shows that they're not really an independent party. They're towing the line from Brussels and Washington. So there's Russian and Ukrainian nurses testifying that hospitals are being bombed and civilians are being hurt. So this is not a humanitarian effort. It's a smokescreen. Mm-hmm. This is aggression. This is a war of aggression against Libya.
You know, and there's that big unanswered question on the other side to this. I alluded to it just now. Who actually the rebels are, and are they allied forces? Any close?
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and I'm talking about Nuremberg. Charles Kraft, who is an amazingly accomplished and inventive artist, by the way, another gifted German-American, has commented about my program of February 21st with Andres Wessele that we never really got into the Jews who ran the IMT, and he sent me some suggestions, and I agree with him. I haven't, and I've been trying to find a way to do that. So I just went through a timeline with you, and now I'm going to start at the beginning with some interesting info and reflections and see how far I get. I will probably continue this next week. In fact, I'm sure I will, because I'm only going to get into the kind of introductory material here, but it's so interesting. Now, the four classifications of crimes, I will remind you and myself, dreamed up for the IMT were participation in a common plan or conspiracy for the accomplishment of crime against peace. So it's participation in crime against peace. And the second one, planning, initiating and waging wars of aggression and other crime against peace. So here we have another similar. This one is planning aggression against peace. And then the third one is war crimes, and the fourth is crimes against humanity. You may wonder how they turn this into four things, but we're going to talk right at the moment of the crime against humanity. But I do want to mention that last week I said there were seven organizations in Germany that were considered criminal by the tribunal, and I read that somewhere, but now I read that there are six, and they are the Nazi leadership of the Nazi Party. Again, just the leadership, not everybody who was a member. The leadership of the Nazi Party, which included quite a lot of leadership, the SS in total, the SD in total, that's the SS security division, and the Gestapo in total, and the SA in total. But I said that the Wehrmacht was considered criminal, but it is the Wehrmacht General Staff and High Command, comprising several categories of senior military officers. So there was the military officers went down pretty far, so they had quite a lot of them that they considered criminal, but not the soldiers and the general population of the Wehrmacht. Now, the Nuremberg Trials Crimes Against Humanity charge was a new wrinkle in international law based on a word, genocide, supposedly invented by, everybody says it was, by the Polish Jew Raphael Lemkin. But now, was he a Polish Jew? Lemkin was born in Russia, now what is now called Belarus, and he was a Russian Jew, and he came to Poland, it seems to me. All Jews came from Russia, or most Jews came from Russia. They all came from Russia. And then they moved west, And they moved into Poland, they moved into Lithuania, they moved into Western Ukraine, they moved into Hungary and Romania, and they moved into Germany, and then they called themselves by these nations, whereas they really had very little in common, and they felt themselves to be Jewish, and they looked after Jewish interests, not the interests of the nation that they were inhabiting. Anyway, genocide is a word that Lemkin coined in 1943, is when it was first used, from the root word genos, is Greek, for family, tribe, or race, and side, which is Latin, for killing. So he put together a Greek and a Latin root word, and then accused the Germans of it. But I'll talk more about him and what he did about that later. So now I want to mention the German thinker Wilhelm Marr, a very important man. He came up with another term, anti-Semitism. So Lemkin invented genocide, and Wilhelm Marr invented anti-Semitism. Marr's speeches and articles showed first indications of anti-Semitism, and he spelled it with no hyphen, all lowercase, no capital S for Semitism, anti-Semitism, all one word. He first used that in 1848, ladies and gentlemen. He was influenced by the Burschenschaft movement of the early 19th century, which was developed out of frustration among German students with the failure of the Congress of Vienna to create a unified state out of all the territories inhabited by the German people. They were pan-Germanists, and what they objected to was that German people were living in places like and dominating places like the Austro-Hungarian Empire, because in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Germans were the bureaucrats that actually ran it, because they were the most capable of that. But you had a large segment of Czechs in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. You had a less large, but a pretty large segment of Hungarians, and you had all kinds of Ruthenians and all sorts of other groups, some Slavic, some not, who were minorities, and that was and a lot of Germans, of course, as I said. So you had a state that was too mixed, and these people didn't think that that was a good idea. They wanted all Germans to be together in their own state. But the Congress of Vienna didn't go along with that, and so they then formed their own group, and they wanted to develop within themselves the Christian German spirit. They wanted to have a nation with a Christian German spirit, and this was a decision of the Burschenschaft Congress. They had their own Congress in 1818, where they decided this. Now, they were opposed to the participation of Jews in their movement, but they did allow for the possibility of the Jewish and other minorities participating in the German state if they were to abandon all signs of ethnic and religious distinctiveness and assimilate into the German Volk. Now, this is something we're all very familiar with, the idea of assimilation, that we can have states which were once predominantly under one group of people, but it's all right if minorities come in, if they will assimilate. Well, we know what happens with assimilation. It doesn't work. And what happened, as I spoke of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, what was objectionable about that was that each of these groups had their distinctive interests, and they bickered and fought with one another, and it was only through the ability of the Habsburg monarchy to negotiate between all these groups to keep some kind of peace going on. It wasn't an ideal situation at all, but they didn't want to lose their large land mass and their huge population of their Austro-Hungarian of their empire. So they worked very hard to try to keep it all functioning. Now, Marr rejected the premise of assimilation as a means for Jews to become Germans. Now, he's kind of stood alone in this at the time. He was very much reviled by a lot of people because he was so firm in his convictions. And he wrote a pamphlet, which in English is called The Way to Victory of Germanicism over Judaism, and this was in 1879. Now, this was 10 years before Adolf Hitler was born, that he wrote this pamphlet. And in it, he introduced the idea that Germans and Jews were locked in a long-standing conflict, the origins of which he attributed to race, and that the Jews were winning. He argued that Jewish emancipation resulting from German liberalism had allowed the Jews to control German finance and industry. Well, this is what we have seen since then, and continuing getting worse and worse. That you can see this as that at one time Jews in Europe were under certain restrictions; they couldn't do certain things. But as that was seen to be, and Jews themselves worked to bring that down, and they were then experienced the emancipation because of growing liberalism, and now they could, they had every right that everyone else had in that nation, and whichever nation it was, and they could become any occupation, they could go into any area and succeed, and pretty soon they were in control of so much, and in Germany they were in control of finance and industry, according to these German nationalists, and according to Wilhelm Marr. Furthermore, since this conflict was based on the different qualities of the Jewish and German races, Marr wrote, it could not be resolved even by the total assimilation of the Jewish population. According to him, the struggle between Jews and Germans would only be resolved by the victory of one and the ultimate death of the other. Now, he doesn't mean here that one has to put to death the other, but that the victory of one, or the dominance of one, will bring about the end of the other as far as dominance, and ultimately more than that, because they will lose their ability to survive, because the dominating group will set things up for their own, in their own interests, and against the interests of the other. A Jewish victory, he concluded, would result in Fini Germane, the end of the German people. And we see that this has just about taken place, ladies and gentlemen. To prevent this from happening, so he, at the same year, 1879, Marr founded the League of Anti-Semites. He came right out with that word. Again, it's all one word, no hyphen, no capital S. And this was the first German organization committed specifically to combating the alleged threats to Germany. Well, they call it the alleged, from this source I'm taking this from, the threat to Germany posed by the Jews and advocating their forced removal from the country. So Marr, in his anti-Semitism league, was advocating that Jews be removed from the country in 1879. This is an idea that the National Socialists adopted, but they didn't. They weren't the first to bring it forth. Now, Marr's ideas were not even adopted by the German nationalists at that time. They thought he went too far. The Pan-German League, which was founded in 1891, after Marr's founded his anti-Semitism league, originally allowed for the membership of Jews, provided they were fully assimilated into German culture. There's that assimilation again. I want to comment that this is a weak position, a weakening that always takes place, when you say, well, if you assimilate, what is the result? A few people, there are certain ones that can assimilate. And then that makes everything possible for all the rest. And under the guise of assimilating, they're actually taking over. And this is what we've seen happen again and again. So I won't take time to go into that. I will go on to say that it was only in 1912, 8 years after Marr's death, that this Pan-German League changed their mind on this, and they declared that racism, well, this source is using the word racism, I would say racialism, they declared that racialism as an underlying principle was what they stood for. And now Marr, at the end of his life, he published a final essay entitled Testament of an Anti-Semite, in which he explained the history of his thinking, asserting that he had originally been a philo-Semite, which is true. In his earlier life, until 1879 or so, he was always pro-Jewish. He was helping the Jews. He was very liberal-minded about that, or emancipation-minded. But something happened to cause him to change his mind and make an abrupt about face. I don't know how abrupt it was, but he made an about face and decided that was a totally wrong position that he had been holding. So he said he had been a philo-Semite because he disliked what he called the romantic madness of Germanism, that is, that German mysticism, and which affected so many German nationalists. And he condemned what he called the beer drinking leaders, the gay Heil shouters of modern anti-Semitism, and the crude prejudice against Jewish writers and thinkers. Now, there is that element, and I agree that anti-Semitism should not be on an emotional basis where you recruit people on a kind of just to hate them this was going on, you know. He says the Heil shouters, that was long before Hitler came on the scene, or the National Socialism. So Heil is, of course, a word that Germans have always used. It means hail. but anti-Semitism, I think, is not something that is criminal and insane and irrational. It is something that is has a serious basis of truth, but it should be presented on a scientific historical basis, not on sloganeering. So, and also anti-Semitism, in the one word form, according to Marr, is the less emotional attitude of recognizing intellectually the incompatibility of the two groups, Jews and Germans. It's not based on blind hatred. It's based on scientific and historical observation. And I can just point to Kevin McDonald's scholarly observations about Jews in society as an example of that. There's plenty of examples of that. And even Hitler wrote some examples, but there were institutes who came up with a lot of that. So there's a lot to be said, a lot of reasons. It is not hatred, and it should not be sloganeering. So here we have now a German who coined the term anti-Semite against the Jews, and a Jew who coined the term genocide against the Germans. Kind of interesting. Now, further, it's obvious that anti-Semitism, with the hyphen and the capital S, is a non-term, because it's not directed against so-called Semitism. It's directed against Semites, or people of Semitic origin. It's directed against people or individuals or a group of people. Whereas anti-Semitism in the one-word form is a generic term which signifies an attitude to a particular group of people. You see, it's an attitude. It's not against the people. It is an attitude about what they are, what they represent, and what effect it has on the rest of us, on a particular group, say the Germans in Germany, what effect the Jews in their nation, having freedom to do whatever they want, and the same rights as all the German people, what effect it has on the Germans. Now, I want to just quote a philosopher, Zvi Diesendruck. Now, he must have been a German Jew, pointed out, and he, quote, "There has never been coined a standing term for the merely negative attitude to any people, other people in history." Isn't that interesting? You see, he says only anti-Semitism, only against the Jews. That's very interesting. The Jews should pay attention to this. There has never been another group of people that such a standing term has been directed against. There's been no people except the Jews that all the people in the world have a problem with. And they are the only people in history who have this sense of others being against them. So they have to look at themselves, don't they? This is about them. It's not about us. It's about them. So I am, you know, I'm never going to use the hyphen anti-Semitism again or the capital S. But this is what I've noticed since I read this. I've noticed that everywhere it is used that way. Even when they're talking about people who have written it in one word, anti-Semitism without the capital S, they change it as they discuss it to the other form, anti-Semitism. So this is something that the Jews want, and we should stop using it for ourselves. Now back to Lemkin in the short little bit of time that I have left. Raphael Lemkin, he was in Bialystok, and then he went to the University of Lviv, and that was in what became Poland. And it was supposedly there that he became interested in the concept of the crime, which was later to evolve into the idea of genocide. But at the time, he was studying the Armenian experience at the hands of the Ottoman Turks, and then later the experience of the Assyrians that were massacred in Iraq during 1933. So in 1934, he was working for the Polish government, but he was fired by the Polish foreign minister for some comments he made. And then he went to work as a private lawyer in Warsaw. You know, he studied international law. Jews go into law, and they go into international law because they want to influence laws in their favor. And that's the purpose of that. Now, when Germany occupied Poland, Lemkin was arrested, and he was prisoner for a year in a prison. You know what he was imprisoned for? He was arrested for miscarriage of justice of citizens of German nationality. He was miscarrying justice against German nationals in Poland because, as we know, how German nationals were persecuted in Poland. In 1939, he joined the Polish army, he says, and he defended Warsaw. Then he, though, received permission to go to the United States in 1941. Now, how did he had special friends in the United States who helped him go to the United States in 1941. And once he got there, he was able to join the law faculty at Duke University. And then, in the summer of 1942, he lectured at the School of Military Government in Virginia. And from these lectures, he wrote a military government in Europe paper that was a preliminary version of a book he wrote, Axis Rule in Occupied Europe. And so in 1943, based on all this, because supposedly he was an expert in international law, he was appointed to the U.S. Board of Economic Warfare, and he became a special advisor on foreign affairs, and he became, in 1945-46, an advisor to Supreme Court Justice Robert H. Jackson for the Nuremberg trials. So this is how Raphael Lemkin worked his way up to becoming a very big force in the Nuremberg trials against the Germans, or Nuremberg Tribunal. My time is up, ladies and gentlemen. I was not able to cover everything I'd like to. I will be back next week. Thank you for being with me tonight, and hope you return next week. This is Carolyn Yeager. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com. We'll be right back.